And our next segment, of course, with Linda Moulton Howe, we're going to be talking about Morgellons, these strange fibers, still unidentified. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, another hour here with Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, Morgellons disease, what a very strange affliction. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention finally last year saying they're going to take a look at it. But there are a lot of people out there that were screaming and nobody would listen.
Oh, is that ever for sure? And I recall the very first time that I saw photographs that were of these strange fibers that were either in people's skin or had been taken out of people's skin, and they were under a microscope. And one of the first things that hit me was that it reminded me of the way a fungus grows. And today, they are still not identified. And this medical mystery has only had a name for about 10 years, this Morgellons disease. Mm-hmm. CDC refers to it as the Morgellons syndrome. And for the first time on March 29th this year, the Charles Holman Foundation organized a conference in Austin, Texas, specifically to talk about Morgellons and how to raise serious money for medical research. Symptoms of Morgellons include itching, painful lesions that open up on the skin, and under a microscope, very small fibers that can look sort of bluish or red or translucent or even brown can be seen in the lesions under a magnifying glass, and people pull them out with tweezers. When they are pulled out, patients will say that they have some comfort for a while, but then the fibers come back. Recently, I talked with one of the pioneers in Morgellons research. He is Randy Wymore, PhD, director of the Center for Investigation of Morgellons Disease at Oklahoma State University, and he is associate professor of pharmacology at OSU Center for Health Sciences in Tulsa. I asked him if there has been any progress in finding out exactly what the composition of these red, blue, brown, and white fibers is.
Here we go.
More samples have been looked at in our collaboration with the Tulsa Police Department Forensics Lab. They have analyzed a few more fibers. And interestingly enough, they claim that a couple of these Morgellons fibers don't match anything in the database. Well, does that happen very often? Well, first of all, I asked specifically that question last time I was over there, and I was told that whenever they get samples that they do something called FTIR spectroscopy on, it always comes up with a match, except in the case of the Morgellons fibers. So the technology works great. It's the samples, the Morgellons fibers, that are the unusual thing in this process. And of course, one of the problems here is that everyone who does this basically is just doing it out of the goodness of their heart or out of intellectual curiosity. We don't have any sort of large funding that would allow many people to work on this full time. So as a result, I'm constantly trying to find experts in different fields, of which I am not, to try and move this forward.
We assume that police departments and their forensic labs are good enough to analyze evidence to stand up in courts of law. What have the forensic experts in the police department that have looked at the Morgellons fibers and not been able to come up with a match in a technology that they use all the time, what have they said about that?
Well, they're completely blown away by it. In both cases, the two fiber experts at the Tulsa Police Department Forensics Lab, each of them has over 25 years of experience doing this. And both of them participated in this, both visually and doing spectroscopy. And, you know, they're just shocked that there could be something like this that is so out of the ordinary. Now, they're familiar with Morgellons disease and familiar with the whole controversy of dermatologists saying, well, this is impossible. This is nothing more than an internet hysteria and a subset of delusions of parasites. Their feeling as non-medical people is, well, but the very thing that these people are complaining about, these fibers, they don't match anything in the database, so they can't simply be environmental contaminants, so there really must be some sort of unusual new disease. Something to understand about the police forensics lab, they analyze it in great detail, but what they're doing is trying to match to knowns. they're not equipped to try and take an unknown and sort through all of the various peaks and troughs on this FTIR fingerprint, as it were, to try and figure out what the composition of these are. That's not their area. And that's where I need the academic or industrial strength, chemist, material scientist, to be able to sort through this to try and figure out what these things are actually made of.
Has anyone tried energy dispersive spectroscopy to try to at least analyze what exactly is in these fibers?
It may sound odd, but there is a geologist I'm working with who is going to do something similar to that. It's a type of laser ablation that they use on geological material to try and get elemental composition. And they can do this with very, very tiny samples, which, of course, many of these Morgellons fibers are visible to the naked eye, but only if you have really good eyes. They're about the size of, a child's eyelash. So if you had that in a tweezers and you held it up to the light and you've got decent eyes or good glasses, you can see it, but it's tiny. So basically what they'll do is hit it with a high-energy laser, which will vaporize the material, and then it gets sucked up into a little chamber where the spectroscopy is done on it. So at the very least, we hope to have an elemental analysis done within the next couple of months. All I can say is that definitely Morgellons fibers that we have had analyzed, and not just the spectroscopy, but other properties too, the high temperature exposure that these fibers can take without giving off any volatile gases. I haven't found any applications where at well over 1,000 degrees, all of the organic compounds haven't been volatilized away. And that doesn't happen with our fibers.
Is it fair for me as a reporter to summarize that you and others have been trying to analyze these fibers since at least 2004 in some capacity, but by April of 2008, even the police forensic laboratories who have volunteered to analyze fibers have not been able to come up with any match?
Yes, because they do not match anything. It's not that they haven't looked hard and used the correct databases to find these things. It's that in all of the databases that they use, and it's not just by one technique, it's not just the FTIR spectroscopy. They've also done mass spec called pyrolysis mass spec. So what they do is heat the fibers in a vacuum chamber. And then so normally what would happen is if you had, whether it's cotton or hair or nylon or rayon or whatever, if you put a little fragment of that in this device, they evacuate the air, make a vacuum, heat it, and then the various organic compounds that the substance is made of, as you get to the boiling point, those vaporize away. It's detected in the device and then looks through the database of compounds to see what it most likely is. And the problem is, if there's nothing vaporizing away, there's nothing to compare to. And so that particular database is somewhere around 90,000 different organic compounds. Well, with the Morgellons fibers that this technique was tried on, after it had gone through this process and the vacuum was released and air let back into the chamber, the forensic scientists were able to reach in with their tweezers and still pick up the fiber. It was still a fiber after all this. It had not been reduced to ash. Now, it had blackened and it had changed its shape. So it was being affected by the temperature, but not to the point of completely breaking down as normally would be the case. The particular pyrolysis mass spec that the Tulsa Police Department lab used, they had taken it to the upper range of their machine. I mean, they can't make it hotter.
The fibers are still there, and that's part of the puzzle. But who do you go to go higher in temperature?
A materials chemistry, analytical chemistry lab, some organic chemistry labs would be able to do that. Even if we can get the elemental analysis or get these FTIR signatures analyzed by someone who can spend the time to try and sort through, here's some double bonded carbons, here's a methyl group, here's a hydrogen, you know, that might give us some sense of what these things are made of.
Is there any reason to have not gone immediately to a materials lab and said, here's what happened in the organics lab, can you take the temperature up and tell us what this is?
Well, I have to find someone who's just willing to do that out of interest.
And one recent discovery that Dr. Wymore told me about is that a doctor at OSU decided to use a handheld dermatoscope to look at the skin of a Morgellons patient where there were no sores or obvious fibers. And to her surprise, she found what looked like two or three dark possible fibers underneath the skin. It's not broken. There's no sore. She's just seeing these dark spots underneath the skin on this patient. Well, then when she opened the skin up at those places, she lifted out what was there and she put it on a microscope slide with a drop of saline. And then there was this huge mass of brownish to translucent Morgellons fibers. They had not seen anything like this. And the implication is that whatever the disease syndrome is and however it produces these still unidentified fibers, these strange fibers can cluster in spots under unbroken skin, in addition to breaking through the skin and creating these very painful sores that affect Morgellons patients. And Morgellons is not only the strange fibers in the sores. Brain problems have been reported in some patients before even the skin symptoms, and sometimes it's the other way around, but it seems to have a really wide nervous system effect, both in the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. The patients say that it feels like their hands or feet suddenly feel like pins and needles, feeling like their skin is going to sleep. But,
right,
but
yeah.
They're not sitting on their hands or their feet. They just feel this. And sometimes patients develop difficulty in walking or in the use of fine motor skills with their hands. And the funny thing about this is these symptoms come and go. And then in the central nervous system in the brain, the patients often discuss, and this phrase actually came out of Morgellons' history, the patients will say, it's brain fog. It's like my brain is now in fog. And they lose their ability to focus their thoughts, sometimes blacking out, where they will forget what they were doing or why they were doing it. And it can progressively, it can get worse to the point where they actually cannot function. And then sometimes it gets better for a short period of time, coming and going. And this is really interesting. I learned about this from Dr. Wymore just for this interview, that there are some Morgellons patients that go through periods when they will be functioning, they will be talking with somebody, and then just like that, they stop. They cannot speak. And their inability to be able to speak just like that in the middle of a sentence, it may last for another week, 2 weeks, a month, 2 months, they never know. And then, as if somebody throws a switch, they will go from not being able to speak to suddenly picking back up, and they can speak, and their motor ability may increase, and that if they had walking problems with not being able to speak, then suddenly they may be walking and talking again. And I ask Dr. Wymore, does this imply, and I know this is not a pleasant thought, but we are in a completely unknown area. Could it be that these fibers can develop in brain tissue?
Oh, my.
And nobody knows. And he said, maybe, but he's looking at the research avenue. Could the fibers, whatever they are, if they could just get them analyzed, could they produce a neurotoxin that could float around in the bloodstream, and maybe it increases in quantity and decreases, and it may be that there's certain levels in which it affects the brain. The brain kicks into all of these strange neurological problems, and then perhaps the neurotoxin reduces for some unknown reason, and then the person comes back to normal and comes in and out. And you can see for the patients who are suffering with this, it is literally a medical hell. And for the first time, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has granted Kaiser HMO in California money to do an epidemiological study beginning this spring of 2008 to see how many Kaiser medical claims might be related to the Morgellons syndrome. And they expect this epidemiology study will go on for a year to the spring of 2009. And I think given the fact that until now, CDC took the attitude of many dermatologists and classified the Morgellons complaints as a mental neurosis. Dr. Wymore discussed it as delusions of parasites. Well, perhaps now this California epidemiological study means that CDC is going to start taking this seriously. And I'm quoting from a conference call that they had recently, the CDC, with other medical people and the media about finally doing an epidemiology study. And this is CDC, quote, "We recognize that many people in the United States and elsewhere are currently suffering with symptoms from the constellation that has been called Morgellon syndrome. They and their clinicians as well are very frustrated by the absence of any clear evidence of whether this is a distinct condition, what might cause it, and how it can be effectively treated. We hope that this first study with Kaiser provides a foundation that will begin to address these important questions." So this is a sea change, George, that the CDC is having conference calls, getting money out there to a place like Kaiser in California, and saying, let's see how many people we can find that fall into this category, and then what do we do next?
You know, we're on the cutting edge, Linda, all of us. You know, the honeybee deterioration, the rising food prices caused by, you know, the use of too much corn for ethanol.
Right.
Morgellons. Next half hour, we'll talk about the strange lights in the skies. I mean, I wish mainstream would get on board on some of these and really begin to exploit it. Maybe we could get this thing done. We can't do it alone.
George, Coast and Earth Files are mainstream.
Well, and when I mean mainstream, I mean where the general public will watch it on television. In terms of radio, I mean, we are mainstream, of course. But, you know, we're late night, Linda. We've got this core millions of audience listening. But I'm talking about mainstream. And they're just not doing this.
To get it leveraged, to get things leveraged into political action, it takes all of the attention that MSNBC is now giving to the election. And the fact that we see that the media tends to move to a story like sex, politics, war, and a campaign, and then they will just run it in 24-hour cycles without ever paying attention to much of anything else.
Constantly, over and over again, were some major issues here that could affect all of us and our children for many years to come, merely are being ignored.
But I think that my Coast broadcast a year ago about Morgellons, that's what Randy Wymore and others have said, did begin to raise consciousness. The snowball began to go down a hill. And that means that even sometimes when we think that people are not listening and that political action is not leveraged, a year later, look at what is happening. So,
well, I know they're listening. You know, I was at the X conference last weekend in the Washington, D.C. area, and I know there were people from government in the audience. I mean, they were in there. They were taking notes. They were very quiet. They weren't participating like the hundreds of other people who were in attendance. They're watching.
Right.
They're listening. They're looking at your website. They're looking at ours. And, you know, they're putting this together. But I think they're doing it for their own greedy purposes, Linda. I don't think they're doing it to better mankind. I think they're doing it to say, oh, they're catching on to us.
Well, that is one of the big problems. Greed and power are running this planet, and the decisions are definitely not in the favor of the common man.
Up next with Linda Moulton Howe, we'll look at some of the strange lights that have been occurring around the United States. Perhaps you've seen them. I'm George Norrie. Coast to Coast AM continues. Yep, about 8 feet under. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with Linda Moulton Howe, Conversations with Linda. But when we come right back, what's been going on in the skies all over Phoenix, Stephenville, Texas, Indiana, Illinois, Massachusetts, Florida? Seems to be all over the place. Lights in the sky. But much more than just lights. They seem to have structure to it. What's going on? In a moment, Linda will help get us through that on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, I can't remember a time period where we have had so many reports of lights, objects in the sky, all at the same time. Can you?
Not quite like what has been happening since January because of the complexity of what people are seeing. And this half hour, you're going to hear a range that reflects basically what was happening in Texas in January to February, but happening in Indiana and Illinois and in Massachusetts. And at the end, I'll talk a little bit about the Phoenix Red 4 lights that might be flares and might not be. But there was a lot of high strangeness, specifically between April 16th and April 18th. Now, I'm going to go back to 4:37 a.m. Central on Friday, April 18th first.
Not too long ago. All right.
38 miles northwest of Evansville, Indiana. There is that magnitude 5.2 earthquake. It hits about 7 miles deep. It shook people awake in Illinois, Missouri, Iowa, Michigan, Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, Kansas, and Georgia, nearly 900 miles away. The Indianapolis International Airport closed down for an hour while the control tower was evacuated, and this was the first strong earthquake in the Midwest since 1968, 40 years ago. Well, northeast of this epicenter is Kokomo, Indiana. And 2 days before the earthquake on April 16th, the 911 emergency center was flooded with nearly 150 phone call reports between 10:25 and 10:40 p.m., a short period window, just going crazy with phone calls, about bright lights in the sky and a loud explosion or boom that was violently rattling houses and windows. Authorities were quick the next day to say, and this is a quote, "It was a mid-air mistake Wednesday night when at least two F-16 jets in routine training exercises with the Indiana Air National Guard went too fast at 10,000 feet and caused a sonic boom on the ground," unquote. But the Mutual UFO Network received a series of alleged UFO sightings on that night of April 16th from Kokomo, Indiana residents. And here is one example. Quote, "At approximately 10:30 p.m. on the night of April 16, I was in the living room watching TV and my husband had gone to bed. There was a huge boom that rattled the front window. My husband asked, what was the noise? And I went to the front door to see. Off to the west, there appeared a large object with lights all the way across it. It reminded me of a hair barrette with lights. It seemed to be hovering, and yet the lights appeared to turn around it. My husband came out to stand behind me just in time to see the lights reappear from right to left until five lights were showing. And then this did a second time, this five repeating lights before it disappeared. The lights that we saw with our naked eye were yellowish orange in color. If you click on WWKI.com radio, their website, there is an article about this boom and the bright lights. You will see pictures that someone submitted. The fourth picture down is exactly what I saw when I first looked out in the sky. And in my Earth Files news report right now tonight at www.earthfiles.com, you can click the hot link to go to this story about the lights in Illinois, Indiana, and Massachusetts, and you can see that photograph that she is specifying and others. And, George, they look exactly like the colored beads, that's what I call them, in those complex patterns that were in the Stephenville videotape of the projected symbols and in the photographs that the constable Leroy Gayton's wife Wendy took back in early February. Well, this woman then continues, quote, "This was no meteor or F-16. They don't hover. We, We could not take our eyes off of it. And my husband, who is a Vietnam veteran and a retired deputy sheriff, said he had never seen anything like it. We are both certain that what we saw was unidentifiable, unquote. Well, the next day, WWKI Radio in Kokomo, Indiana, posted these images on its website under this headline, Big Boom, Lights in the Sky, question mark. And then it said that between 10 and 11 p.m. on April 16th, a man named Dustin Cronkite took these photos. And the radio website says to listeners, quote, take a look at these pictures. After you do, take the poll and let us know what you think they are, unquote. And at Earth Files, in my news report entitled Strange Aerial Lights Like Texas, but now photographed in Indiana, Illinois, and Massachusetts, I have all of those photographs and all of these others that I'm talking about tonight so that everybody can compare Texas, Indiana, Illinois, what was happening in all of these different places in Massachusetts. Now, the big booming noise and earthquake hit 2 days later in the early morning of Friday, April 18th. So there was a boom then, too. There's a boom 2 nights before, and then there's a huge boom with the earthquake. And that afternoon, I received an email from a professional photographer in Massachusetts. Her name is Courtney Lynn Wilson Merrill, and she lives in Holyoke. She and her husband have good friends in Granville, which is about 20 minutes southwest. And Courtney was emailing me on that Friday to alert me that her Granville friends were seeing very strange and colorful lights flashing in the sky that week that they thought reminded them of what had been discussed in Texas. Hmm. Well, then that very night, after she had sent me that email, around 10 p.m., Courtney got a call from Dan Vierno in Granville, one of their friends, who said they were now watching two more of these bright lights with spinning colors, and it was sitting right above the trees near his house in Granville. And another of Courtney's friends and an eyewitness to the strange flashing lights is Richard Guzman. He's 39 years old with a background as a computer salesman and now is a detail mechanic for a van servicing in Granville. His house is about 5 minutes up the road from Dan Vierno's. It's more isolated. He's in the Granville Mountains. Well, an odd, colorful flashing light first caught his attention from his bedroom window on Tuesday, April 15th, and Rich couldn't figure out what the light was that night and was even more surprised when his friend Dan Vierno called him on Thursday night, April 17th, and told Rich to go outside to see at least five bright flashing lights. And when I'm talking to him about those five, he's taking the phone outside and sees three more during this interview.
Here we go.
The 17th, I had a phone call from my friend Dan. And Dan said, Rich, you got to look up the sky. I think there's something up there, and I don't know what it is, but I think there are definitely UFOs up there. I'm like, UFO? What are you talking about? So I'm looking up to the sky, and I'm looking, and I'm seeing these flashing lights, and I grab my binoculars, and I look up, and he's on the phone with me at the same time, you know? Mm-hmm. He's like, what do you see? And I'm like, there's like these flashing silver lights, and they go from silver, and then they went to red, and then they went to blue.
How many do you think were in the sky at the same time doing these odd color flashes?
Me, what I witnessed, I'm going to say at least over five.
And were they in any kind of a pattern themselves in relationship to each other?
I saw one of them that looked kind of like a long triangle. Like there was like one that was pointed west, one was pointed north, and one was pointed south. It was weird because the triangle was long, not facing downward, but sideways.
Three of these pulsing lights forming themselves into a formation of a long triangle.
Yeah, exactly. The one that I saw really vivid, it was moving and doing this little jagged movement. It's like moving a little bit and then staying in the spot. Moving a little bit and then staying in the same spot. I don't know. I never seen anything like it in my life.
if you've got one long triangle formation of three of them, what were the other pulsing lights? What kind of pattern were they in?
In the triangle formation, they didn't really move. There was one I saw separate that was like bigger and vibrant. That's the one I saw just move a little bit and then stay still and then move a little bit and then stay still. And then I could see like silver, like it was just like a silver, whitish color. You know, it's weird, hard to describe it. But I do recall when Dan was talking to me, he's like, Rich, I saw blue lights and red lights. And I think he said green too, but I saw red and blue lights. For me, I think they're still out there. You know what I mean? That's what I'm thinking. I told Dan that, and he came up here yesterday, and they were still up there, but they were moving towards the west.
You mean that you all saw this Saturday night, April 19th as well?
Yeah. They were more towards the west. And I'm seeing one right now. I'm outside right now, and I'm seeing it. And I'm going to focus my binoculars. Yep, there it is. I'll be a son of a gun. It's mostly silver right now. It's flashing lights. It looks like it's like Christmas lights, and it's not. It looks like little crystal silver lights, almost like a yellowish tint, and it's flashing.
It's silver now?
Yeah, it's silver now.
So this is exactly what you all saw on the 17th?
And there it is. Looks green. Yeah, it's flashing. What is that?
So it has changed from silver to green.
Yeah.
No movement of the object itself?
No, it's not moving. It's staying still.
Do you have any way to photograph it?
No, I don't. Wish I did. I just saw red flashing lights, and now it's back to silver.
Do you know anybody you could call and say, can you get a camera with a lens on this and take some photographs?
Well, it's kind of hard for me. I'm up in the mountains, so there's not really many neighbors. There might be another one there, but it's hard to tell because it's cloudy.
Two of them are sort of below the cloud ceiling?
And I think I just found a third one.
So they have to be under the cloud cover.
Yep. There's the other one. There's three of them now.
Okay. And they all are doing the same thing.
Yeah. It's mostly silver and then flashing red and then flashing bluish green. Like, that is so bizarre.
All of you are convinced that you're watching something that is not astronomical or military.
No. This is like flashing color lights. And no way. This is the strangest thing I've ever seen since I was born on this planet. I'll tell you that much. I've never, ever seen anything like this at all.
And I have heard that same reaction from so many of the eyewitnesses. There is something about the way this is so big and bright in the sky when it appears and has this merry-go-round appearance. That's what they called it in Texas. It looks like a merry-go-round of lights moving inside of whatever the disk or the sphere is. And believe it or not, on that same day of April 18th, I received at earthfiles.com yet another email from a man named Brandon Johnson about a very unusual digital photograph that his 9-year-old niece, Gabriel Johnson, had taken back a ways on Saturday, April 5th, from her yard in Oswego, Illinois. And he included his niece Gabriel's photograph. And I was impressed that the image was so similar to the photographs in Kokomo, Indiana, at the radio website, what we had in the video and in the constable's photograph in Stephenville, Texas. And you can see her Oswego, Illinois photo that looks like colored beads again, strung together in a kind of swirly pattern at my Earth Files news report tonight, where I am comparing all of these photographs and videos from this month, that they seem to imply that something highly strange left the skies of Stephenville and Dublin, Texas, and is now flashing its color in several other parts of the United States. And if any Coast listener has seen these odd spinning color and pattern changing objects, sometimes appearing to project what looks like symbols from whatever this sphere is in the sky, or you have photographs or videotapes, I sure would appreciate an email to earthfiles@earthfiles.com. You can compare what you have at the website, earthfiles.com, and let me know if you think that you have seen or videotaped or photographed anything like it, I would like to try to talk to as many people who are seeing or interacting with whatever this phenomenon is, partially to find out how widespread it is beyond Indiana, Illinois, Massachusetts, and Texas. And that brings us up, George, to Monday,
what a story.
April 21st. Yes, and it's ongoing. I mean, I really think that we've had this episode in April that's been intense, and I don't feel like anything's going away. I think we're kind of keep waiting for more shoes to drop.
Mm-hmm. I do too.
And one of them, even though it's screwy and confusing, was Monday, April 21st. And this is what happened over the North Valley of Phoenix. Now, I started with getting a hold of Brad Drenning. His home is near 7th Street and Union Hills Drive in North Phoenix, relatively close to where these four strange vivid red lights in the sky were. And I talked with him on the 22nd, saw his excerpt of his video, one of the best I have ever seen, clear, not wobbling around. And he and his wife and his 16-year-old son and his 8-year-old daughter, they all were in the backyard. They were all seeing these lights. Neighbors had called to alert them. He gets his videotape camera, and he videotapes for 14 minutes. Now, if you go to earthfiles.com, I have the 14 minutes are broken into three hot links. And you can just click on those links, and it takes you right to his videotape, which is so good. And in the second, we'll call it the second segment, broken up for the size of the megabytes, it was a continuous videotape. But in the
which is a long time for UFO, 14 minutes or so. Yeah.
Absolutely. This is really important to consider in what evolved into people saying, oh, no, there's a guy who says that he launched four helium balloons with these road flares attached. What you see very clear is what looks like a Y, a perfect Y in the sky. And then the red object that is forming the point that would make the V of the Y, it begins moving very steadily at a pretty rapid rate and just moves right up, right through the two, right in the middle, and stops, like just stops. And there it looks like a kite or a diamond in the sky. And Whitley Strieber looked at it. Jim Mars looked at it. I have studied that videotape. And everybody's reaction is, in the wake of the ABC 15 going out and interviewing a neighbor, not the so-called perpetrator, but a neighbor who says that he watched his neighbor take four helium balloons, two white, two black, attach these road flares by strings and release them without any control on the balloons, is the story. How in the world can you look at these 14 minutes of videotape that Brad Drenning has shot and see this fluid motion of starts and stops? As Brad told me, he said in those 14 minutes, about every 2 minutes, the red lights would move as if choreographed to change into a new pattern. And I find this to be quite confusing. And the other thing that I don't understand is, if the ABC 15 reporter was standing in the backyard of the person who is saying they saw this, and his cameraman walks over to the wall and aims at the back trellis of where the perpetrator is supposed to have launched the balloons, why didn't the reporter go and knock on the door of the alleged hoaxer and ask?
They're not like you, Linda. That's why. We'll be back. Linda Moulton Howe and your phone calls. Conversations with Linda in our final hour on Coast to Coast AM.